Our goal is to not only raise awareness about obviously what's happening in Palestine and Gaza, but to also start divestment campaigns, which is divesting from study abroad programs in Israel.
As a Jewish person living in LA, I feel like it's important for me to come out here and show that anti-Zionist Jews exist.
I've decided that I'm not as scared as I was before to speak up. I would be ashamed if I didn't use my voice now.
USC students speaking with Annenberg Media during a campus walkout in support of Palestinians yesterday. That issue, the war, has become even more volatile now. USC has decided to bar its valedictorian from speaking at next month's commencement. Asma Tabassum is Muslim of South Asian descent and has been public about her pro-Palestinian views. USC Provost Andrew Guzman said in a statement yesterday that discussions surrounding her selection as valedictorian had, quote, taken on an alarming tenor, which have, quote, escalated to the point of creating substantial risks relating to security and disruption at commencement. He said this was not a free speech issue. But Tabassum says in a written statement that she's shocked by the decision. She says she's, quote, profoundly disappointed that the university is succumbing to a campaign of hate meant to silence my voice, end quote. This is the first time USC has banned a valedictorian from speaking, but it's just the latest example of how the Israel-Hamas conflict is roiling college campuses. Joining me now is Javed Kalim, reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and he's been covering this issue. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline.
All right, so tell us more about USC's decision. What was it in response to?
So ever since USC announced their valedictorian, Asma Tabassum, early this month, almost immediately, there was a swift online mob that reacted against this decision. And the reason is, various online groups, pro-Israel groups, saw Asma's Instagram page, and it had a link in her bio to a page with a collection of informational cards and links about Palestine and Israel. These organizations said that her the statements there were anti-Semitic. They called Israel a settler colonial society. They suggested Israel's creation was invalid. And so people said she was anti-Jewish and came up strong against USC and demanded that they rescind this.
And USC thought, okay, this is just generating too much heat and it'll make commencement unsafe and therefore best to rescind the invitation?
So usually as a valedictorian, you speak to 65,000 people who gather each year. You get, you know, up to 5 minutes of talk. It's a really big deal. And you apply and USC selects you based upon not just your GPA, but your essay and other activities. And once I spoke to USC, the provost and the director of security, they were very vague about what actually prompted them to make this decision. They said there were threats, and they said threats were coming from people who said they'd be in campus as soon as this week. But they did not say whether it was a bomb threat, a threat of a shooting, who it the threat was aimed at specifically. They just said it was too much of a security issue to let this speech go forward.
And what has been the reaction to that decision on campus?
Campus groups, they have a Students for Justice in Palestine or related group like that. They have a faculty group that supports Palestinians. Both of those have spoken out against this decision. They say it's unprecedented and that the student is being targeted for her views on Israel and Palestine. There are some Jewish groups on campus or some pro-Israel groups, one called Trojans for Israel, that had demanded that she not be allowed to speak. And I would imagine they are happy with this decision.
Well, how active was she in the pro-Palestinian worlds, and how much had she been an activist for Palestinians before this?
It's actually unclear. Asna released a long statement yesterday, and she talked about her belief in human rights and her views that she's being silenced, but it didn't include much insofar as her activism. So it's unclear if she's been involved in protests on the streets or things like that. She did have a minor. Her minor is resistance to genocide. And Of course, many people have accused Israel of being involved in a genocide in Gaza. And that accusation has been very offensive to many people who support Israel as well. So aside from her minor and her Instagram page and the link there, it's unclear, you know, how active she really was.
And she's majoring in biomedical engineering. I looked at the course description of resistance to genocide, and there is a lot of instruction on the Holocaust, you know, during World War II. So presumably she would have quite an education on the Jewish experience.
Yeah, that would make sense. When you talk about genocide, that is, you know, one of the biggest modern day genocides, and it is the best known and studied. And it's you know, one that everyone can hopefully name and know about. So I think that's probably the source of some of this scholarship. USC is well known for its scholarship on genocide. They have the Shoah Foundation as well, which documents the testimonies of Holocaust survivors.
Mm. Okay, so there could be an unintended consequence with all this, that there will be even more protests and even more of a perhaps security situation for USC, given the intensity of the feelings on both sides of this issue. Has USC considered that by rescinding its offer for her to speak, that it could be creating an even bigger situation?
They did not indicate that to me when I spoke to officials at USC. They sounded confident that they were preventing things from getting worse. But you are correct, Madeline. Things have already blown up. You know, a student at USC who might be a figure at USC for her achievements now has become a national and even international name.
But this is obviously not happening in a vacuum. There are plenty of kind of similar incidents all over college campuses. We've been reporting on that. And here in California, as well, there's been a lot of activism at Pomona College. We've seen a lot of turmoil at UC Berkeley. Can you describe what you've been reporting on these incidents. Can you describe what you're reporting on and what you've seen on college campuses of late?
Well, for the past 6 months, college campuses have been embroiled in intense activism over Israel and Palestine. The majority of it has been on the pro-Palestinian side. And in general, many of these students have called for divestment campaigns, and they've often been accused of being anti-Semitic for their tactics or their language. And even that accusation has been debated. But, you know, recently Pomona College had several sit-ins and nearly 20 arrests for students who are protesting at UC Berkeley. A group of law school third year graduating students tried to give a speech about Gaza at the home of their dean during a celebratory dinner, which resulted in a viral video confrontation with the dean. So I can only imagine more will happen. Students tend to always make political statements and advocate for causes during graduation time. But now after October 7th, I think it's going to be an even louder season in that regard.
Well, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you, Madeline. Really appreciate it.
That's Javed Kalim, reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Coming up, he single-handedly ousted Kevin McCarthy from the speakership, and he avoided a criminal investigation. How Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz not only survived, but thrived in Congress despite not being very well liked. That's coming up. And a little later, a conversation with actress Janelle James, who plays the incompetent principal on Abbott Elementary. It's her first real TV role. We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A week ago today, during a conversation at Georgetown University, political scientist and KCRW's left, right, and center panelist, Mo Alethi, asked former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy why he lost his job.
And I'll give you the truth why I'm not Speaker. It's because one person, a member of Congress, wanted me to stop an ethics complaint because he slept with a 17-year-old. An ethics complaint that started before I ever became Speaker, and that's illegal, and I'm not going to get in the middle. Did he do it or not? I don't know. But an ethics is looking at it. There's other people in jail because of it. And he wanted me to influence it.
McCarthy was talking about Congressman Matt Gaetz, who denies that allegation and called McCarthy a liar in response. The Florida Republican led the revolt against McCarthy last fall, and my next guest says those two incidents, ousting McCarthy and allegations of having sex with a minor, have defined Gaetz's tenure in Congress. Both of those things should have made him the GOP's persona non grata, and yet he is still ascendant in Republican politics, mainly because Donald Trump likes him. Elaine Godfrey is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she traces Gaetz's rise in a big profile headline, Matt Gaetz is Winning. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so what is going on with that House Ethics Committee investigation?
Oh, boy, what is going on with it? We don't have a ton of information, but it seems like they're reviewing all of the claims plus some more claims that the DOJ was investigating against Gaetz. Now, the Department of Justice already dropped its case against Gaetz, or I should say its investigation into Gaetz, for several charges of having sex with a minor and potentially sex trafficking because he allegedly took a minor on a trip to the Bahamas. So it seems like the House Ethics Committee is investigating those things, as well as additional claims that he might have shown or shared photos or videos of nude women on the House floor or just generally in his work day with his fellow lawmakers, which is something that I talked to at least one former lawmaker about and a few staffers who say that did happen. So the Ethics Committee will investigate that, and we don't really know their timeline, just that they're looking into it, and they have the power, in theory, to censure him, to even propose expulsion of Matt Gaetz if that's something that they deem is necessary.
And why did the Department of Justice drop its investigation?
So it dropped the investigation. I think all we know is it said it didn't have enough evidence to pursue the case. I think that the witness that they had in the case, they said, was not going to be useful to them.
Okay. Even though his former associate, Joel Greenberg, went to jail on these charges.
That's right. I mean, that was a separate case. I mean, he went to jail on many more charges. His was, I think, clearly much easier to, I guess, for the Department of Justice to try.
Okay, you went back in time to find out how Gaetz became Gaetz, and he grew up in Florida, privileged. His father was a well-known Florida state lawmaker, and he literally grew up in the Truman Show house?
He did. That beautiful beachside house that Jim Carrey lives in the Truman Show, that was a vacation property for the Gaetzes, and it is still owned by them. They still live there. His parents still live there, at least for part of the year. And so he grew up there part of the year. And I just thought that was so, as I say in the piece, it's so on the nose because Truman's life was up for public consumption. And it really feels like Matt Gaetz's life is too.
Right. And so he was like a chubby teenager and did well on the debate team. Is that what paved the way for his entry into politics?
Yeah, I mean, it has seemed clear from my reporting that he always wanted to be in politics. And he loved as a kid to argue. People told me he couldn't get enough of debate. He spent all of his time at debate camps and competitions. And I think it helps you understand that this has always been who he is. He loves to argue. He loves to tackle things that are he loves to sort of get an assignment, right? And then figure out how to argue it, how to tear something apart or build something up. And people always said, you know, he didn't have that many friends because he was kind of a jerk. And I think we all, you know, if you knew debate friends, had a debate team in high school, you probably know the kind of guy that Matt Gaetz was as a teenager, like sort of smarmy, sort of mm-hmm. arrogant, a contrarian. So I think that just helped explain a lot about who he is now.
So he gets to Congress and he's kind of irrelevant. And how does he become the guy that you see every night on Fox News?
Yeah. I talked to former staffers of his who said, you know, he decides, you know, it's going to take way too much work, way too much fundraising, frankly, to work your way up at a committee and to, you know, sponsor legislation, build alliances. Instead, he says, let's go straight to the American people through the media. We will talk about every controversial, you know, topic that we can. We will defend President Trump at every opportunity. We will just speak to our voters, the MAGA base, directly. And eventually that gets him the notice of not only, you know, every media outlet, but also the president himself. And he becomes a real darling of the president, a real friend of his, and sort of a willing media servant for him.
Yeah, you talk about that scene in this Fly on the Wall documentary on Matt Gaetz where he gets a call from Donald Trump, and just describe his reaction.
Yeah, he gets a call from Trump.
Hey, Mr. President, it's Matt Gaetz.
And you can sort of hear Trump on the other end saying, you know, well done, Matt, and good job. You're the best defender, Matt, and sort of praising him for something or other that Gaetz has just done.
But I appreciate it very much, Matt.
All right.
I have been watching, and you got some good people with you, too, some great fighters, so we love it. Hey, Matt, I had a phone call with the president of Ukraine. It was perfect. I have a friend of mine who's one of those.
And the camera just lingers on Gaetz's face, and he is so
thank you
pleased.
You're the best, Mr. President.
And proud of himself that he has gotten this call from the president. You can tell it means so much to him.
We will. See you.
You can tell that this is what he's in this for, right? For this connection to power, for this feeling of success. It just really stuck out to me as a really important moment from that documentary.
Right. And so he engineers Donald Trump's endorsement of Ron DeSantis and kind of elevates DeSantis in that way for governor. And so how is he now? Where is he now in the MAGA sphere?
Gaetz now is perhaps even closer to the white hot center of the MAGA sphere. I mean, he didn't lose any traction at all. I mean, there was sort of a moment where maybe he lost some footing. Trump didn't talk about him a lot. He sort of disappeared from Fox News. He wasn't out and about that much. But, you know, pretty quickly, he hit the trail with Marjorie Taylor Greene on the America First campaign to sort of deny the results of the 2020 election. And it just sort of disappeared. You know, Trump apologized to him on stage in Iowa, I think it was, and said, you know, he's been mistreated. We all forgive Matt. And that really sort of did it for him. It just erased his record, at least for that chunk of the electorate. And people feel like, just as they feel like happened to Trump, that he's been a target of political persecution. And so I think he's even better positioned than he was previously in the MAGA movement. He's closer to Trump than ever. He's well positioned, if he wants to run for Florida governor, which is something that a lot of people told me he does want to do and will do.
Wow. And how is he viewed in Congress itself still? I mean, he's the guy who led the ouster of, you know, this longtime Republican member, Kevin McCarthy, who's now in the political wilderness. So how is he viewed in Congress?
Not well. People see him as a real chaos agent in Congress. And he was, right? I mean, I think he was the cause of a lot of heartache for a lot of members of Congress. Of course, he has some friends, I think, most of them. In fact, none of them would speak to me on the record. Publicly, he doesn't have a lot of allies because he's just so, you know, the allegations against him have sort of poisoned him for a lot of moderates and a lot of Republicans who just are not MAGA types. And then this speaker stuff has just really made it worse. His kicking out this guy who was pretty well liked, McCarthy was. I just think people find him annoying, and it is very much the same way that his high school debate team members felt about Matt Gaetz, which is he can be useful. He's around because he has to be, but we just tolerate him. He's kind of an ass. That is sort of the impression they have of him.
Elaine Godfrey, staff writer at The Atlantic, where you can read her profile, Matt Gaetz is Winning. Elaine, thank you.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
On Press Play, we'll talk to Sarah Koenig about her series Serial. The latest season is out now, and it takes place at Guantanamo Bay. Coming up on the program today, Janelle James plays the narcissistic principal Ava Coleman on the hit TV mockumentary Abbott Elementary.
The show is supposedly about the inner city public school system, but Ava brought the cameras there for herself. She's more trying to become famous.
Janelle James is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Abbott Elementary is in its third season on ABC. The hit workplace comedy revolves around an inner city school in Philadelphia and the chaos on any given day. It's shot as a mockumentary, like The Office, with characters speaking into the camera from time to time. They often complain about their principal, who is spectacularly incompetent.
Oh, you're the sub. Forgive me, I thought one of my colleagues here hired a stripper for me.
What do you do here?
I'm the principal.
But you don't do anything.
Ava, you really had to change into that?
Of course I did. The zoo is a mecca for single dads. Better pick us in a Sunday brunch up in there. Now who ready for the zoo?
Tomorrow, Principal Coleman kicks off a school event known as Ava Fest. And joining me now is Janelle James, who plays Ava Coleman of the aforementioned Ava Fest. Welcome.
Yes, Ava Fest is back. Ava Too Fest, I believe it's called.
What is it? What is Ava Fest? Just a celebration of all things Ava?
I mean, it's for the kids. Get out of here. You know how she is.
It's all for the children, of course.
Yeah, fun and games and yet another time for Ava to flex her connections in Philly, maybe bring a guest star. She failed last year. Let's see what happens this year.
Yeah. Okay, well, so how would you describe her? You know, for someone who's never watched the show, let's say, someone from another planet, how would you describe Ava?
I would describe Ava as a shrewd hustler who happens to be a principal of an elementary school.
A shrewd hustler.
Yes. On the surface, it's easy to paint her as many things, but I feel like she is the most layered character on the show and is always has proven to be the smartest person in the room many times. That's what excites me so much about playing her. And if it benefits the kids sometimes, all the better.
Or if it doesn't, who cares? But
who cares? I feel like Ava has, we're in season three now. I'm not going to let you get away with that. I feel like Ava has shown many times that she does care about the kids in it, but this may not be what she leads with or what she's most proud of either. She's not tooting her own all the time that she has uniforms in her desk at the ready to hand out and does fundraising and teaches a step class on her own time. Like she does, she's not tooting her horn about that. She's just doing it. And I think that's cool.
Did she start out that complicated and that big a part of the show, or did that expand over time?
I think first season, as it goes in almost all shows, especially in a pilot, you have to be kind of one note because you're just like, this is this person. This is the teacher. This is the hustler. This is the nerd. This, you know what I mean? You're just kind of introducing the characters. And then if the show is lucky enough to go on, you learn more about them. So yeah, in the first season, it was easy to be like, oh, Ava's just like, you know, so selfish and da da da. And now we go on. It's not that she's doing new things. You see, we're now seeing this. She's always been doing these things. It just wasn't evident in the flashiness of the first season, because I think a lot of people forget the show is supposedly about the inner city public school system, but Ava brought the cameras there for herself. It's an Ava show. So maybe in the first season, she wasn't like, oh, these are all the things I'm doing. She's more trying to become famous, and she succeeded.
Right.
And then now, as the show goes on, and she's less about showboating for the cameras, maybe more less cognizant even that they're there. And now you're seeing what really is happening in this school. And part of it is that, yeah, that she likes the kids. She does stuff with them. I like the episode where she has the uniform for the kid in her drawer, because it's not only that she had the uniform, but she had a rapport with him where she was cracking on him, that you see that this isn't the first time she's done that. People go to get detention. It's a place to calm down. It's not a place of punishment. Like, she's always been that. You just don't see it right away.
Yeah. You know, you began your showbiz career as a stand-up comic.
Yep.
And I want to get into that in a bit, but I just want to ask you first, do you improvise at all Ava's character?
No, not really. End of last season into this season is when I've started, like, even giving ideas. But I very much... because I feel like the writers are killing it. We all try to do it as it is on the paper. And then after we get that, then we'll say our ideas.
Mm-hmm. In real life, when you're off camera and in the real world, do people mistake you for her? Do they think that you're not really playing a character? Part of it is it's like a mockumentary, right? So it's supposed to be real in a way.
Yeah, they're looking at it as if it's a real life show that's happening and filming us for real. And then also, I take it as a testament to how well I'm playing the character that they think I'm a real person. But I always am sad to disappoint them that I don't have half the energy that this character has.
Sounds like you do. Sounds like you do in this conversation. You have a lot of energy.
This is my fifth interview I've done today, so maybe I'm
my God.
But I don't have half the energy or smiles that this woman has, or the desire to be seen. I think that's one way we differ. Like, she definitely wants to be famous. I just happen to be famous.
Well, let's talk about that, because I've read interviews where you describe yourself as a recluse. So
yeah.
that you don't like the attention, you don't like to be out doing the Ava thing in real life. That would you rather be at home on a Saturday night?
I'm definitely a homebody. That doesn't mean I don't like people. I just always, I've noticed, crafted my every place I've lived as a place where people can come to me, because I don't want to go anywhere.
Uh-huh. I get it. I totally get it. And so let's talk about how you got here, because this is your first acting gig, right?
My first real acting gig. I was on camera for a part that I wrote for myself on a show that I wrote on Black Monday. So that was my first time on set. It was almost like a gag. I did not believe I was doing it until I was like in costume on set. So this is my first like true role that I've auditioned for and have taken to the top.
it's kind of a meteoric rise. And so how did that happen? How did you get this role in the first place? Or how did you audition for it? If you were,
yeah.
I mean, you were a writer, a TV writer, as you mentioned,
right.
You wrote for the Showtime series Black Monday and yeah. some other shows. And you were a stand-up comic and you toured and you've toured with Chris
yeah.
Rock and Amy Schumer and,
yeah.
and all these big names. So how did you then get this job and decide, oh, I want to be an actor?
You just said it. I was doing stand-up and I was doing so well, like touring with all those people, those big names. When that happens, you get an agent and then they start sending you scripts to audition for. I didn't have any real designs on being an actor. I always thought, like a lot of comedians start because one of our friends gets a show and then they put you in, you know, like tag you into their show. So I always was like kind of confident that somebody would put me on something, you know,
mm-hmm.
but wasn't like actively auditioning. And my agent sent me this, and they know that I rarely audition for stuff. And I read it and I was like, this is great. And they were like, you should audition. And I was like, yeah, I should. And then I still didn't. And testament to my agent that she kind of stayed on me. Like, I really think I really think this one is good for you. Like, I think you do well. And I finally did. They extended it multiple times for me, which I just take as meant to be, because I really sat on it forever before I finally was like, okay, I'll audition.
Wow. So yeah. And I wouldn't say late in life, but not when people are just starting out getting roles, you know, early on in their lives. You had a full life before that. As I mentioned, writing and doing stand-up, but also as a mom of two kids, as I understand it, and living in Illinois. And so I guess this idea of being in showbiz, how did that come to you? Because you weren't doing this for a while, from what I've read.
I started doing stand-up on a whim. Someone invited me to an open mic. I went. I did a set the next week. And I kept going back. I made friends with those comedians there. We all started doing comedy together. We all started traveling to do comedy in different places. I moved back to New York. I kept doing comedy there. And then from there, things just kept coming. Opportunities kept coming. Bigger people kept seeing me. Chris Rock saw me perform somewhere and then added me to his tour. And then other people saw me from that. And from that, I got a late night opportunity to stand up on late night. And then Don Cheadle saw me doing that. And he got me the writing job on Black Monday. It all just like each thing rolled into the next thing. And so as I'm doing it, never had of like, I'm going into showbiz. I'm just like, oh, I'm doing these cool things. This is fun.
You make it sound so easy.
Everybody makes everything sound easy once you know what you're doing. I've had been doing stand up for 10 years. Mm-hmm. You know, if people think that's easy, they're welcome to try. Yeah.
Yeah. So where did you grow up and how did you grow up?
I grew up in the Virgin Islands. I grew up, I have a big family. I have a lot of siblings. I worked in a family business. My dad had a restaurant. I basically grew up doing sales on a beach. You know, if you've ever been on a beach vacation, there's people would come up, owe you drinks and bracelets and trinkets and stuff. I did that.
Wait, how old were you when you did that?
I mean, I started working when I was 9. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Work when I was 9. I started driving when I was 11. Like, most people who grow up poor get a lot of life skills as children. So maybe at the time I would have rather been swimming, but that has all worked out for me. In this way, I've turned all that work into what I'm doing now. I've been working for a long time, so yeah.
But did you learn that from that, you know, going back to when you were 9 years old and walking along the beach and trying to get customers for your dad's business?
Yeah, my dad is a salesman. Basically, we're in sales. We sold food and drinks, and watching him sell and then me selling myself, and even at that age, knowing how to speak to adults and being in adult situations and just watching people. I think that makes me, I think all the best comedians have lived many lives and they're people watchers. We're observers.
Do you miss doing the stand-up part?
Yeah. Yeah. I still try to do shows. I did a small tour last year to remind myself that I do like it. Take that back, love it, to remind myself that I do love it and to continue. Yeah, I don't think comedians, especially ones who have made it as far as I have, ever stop. It's our sickness. We're addicted to the laughs.
Yeah, and also putting yourself out there, because that seems pretty, I don't know, to the layperson, it seems a little frightening to do that, to get up on stage and be there by yourself telling jokes and hoping they land.
Well, thank God everyone isn't brave enough. That'd be awful.
I know.
If everyone's trying to do stand up, that would be awful. So thank God some people are too scared. Make way for me.
That sounds like a very Ava thing to say.
Hey, I mean, she's a smart lady. I admire.
Do you have a piece of advice for her?
For Ava? Oh. Mm-hmm. She knows everything. What advice would Ava need? Let me think.
Maybe that she doesn't know everything. I don't know.
Ava, you know, that's a funny question because she's always the one giving advice to everyone else. Very sage advice, if you pay attention.
Uh-huh.
She's always gagging everybody, including the character that you would think would be the know-it-all, Barbara, gets very wise advice from Ava at all times. And she's always surprised about mm-hmm. You know, so no, I don't have any advice. I hope she got some advice for me. I'd ask Ava for advice before I get her.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you on the show today. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. That's Janelle James. She plays Principal Ava Coleman on Abbott Elementary, which airs Wednesdays at 9:00 on ABC and then streams on Hulu. The Plant Doctor is in. Hilton Carter is here to tell you how to make more plants from the ones you have. That conversation next on Press Play. You're listening to 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brandt. About a year into the COVID pandemic, when a lot of people became plant parents, we spoke with an interior designer and expert on indoor plants. Hilton Carter, aka the Plant Doctor, had more than 300 indoor plants at the time. He has written 5 books and now has a 3rd interior decor line at Target. His latest book is called The Propagation Handbook. And in it, he tells you how to create more plants from the ones you have. Why? Because it's fun and it's free. Hilton Carter will be in LA on Thursday for an appearance at a plant store called Flora Grub in Venice. And he's here now. Welcome back to Press Play.
Thank you, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
So tell me how many plants you have now.
Well, now.
Can you even count?
I have more. At this point, I definitely probably have more than over 300, but that's not just in my home. It spreads throughout my home and my studio. But I count them based on how many you have to care for, right? So yeah. I have at least 350 probably that I actually care for.
Oh, my gosh. And so how many of those have been propagated?
Oh, many. Probably about 20 to 30 of those plants are propagated, like mature plants. I mean, I have a lot of small cuttings, but we typically don't count a lot of the small cuttings in the home at this point, just because they end up not being ours for too long. Madeline, you might know this, but propagation is the gift that keeps on giving. So I actually propagate a lot so that I can gift them to friends and people that I care for so that they can also enjoy the process of caring for plants.
That's so nice. Okay, so what is the difference between a cutting and propagating? Is it just 2 words for the same thing?
2 words for the same thing. Well, a cutting is something that you take from a plant. So once you take a cut of a plant, that's your cutting. To then propagate it, there's a process to then propagate that plant. You got to go through the steps. You can cut pieces off of any plant, but until you do the things that are going to allow that cutting to then develop roots, then move into some sort of medium to then grow more, so then you can propagate it again or cut it again. That's basically when you are, I guess, successful, let's say, at propagating a plant.
All right. So, like I said, there are a couple of obvious reasons to do this. It's kind of fun to play God, I suppose, and create a whole new living organism.
Plant God.
plant God. But also, it's free. Obviously, you don't have to go buy another plant at the plant store. But isn't it also good for the plant itself to do that?
Yeah, it's the same process of pruning back a plant. You know, you want to encourage new growth. That's the process. When you're propagating the plant, not only are you taking a piece to increase the amount of plants you have, or like we said, to gift, but from where you made the cut on that plant, it will push out new growth. So you can literally trim back. That's why they always prune trees, because you want to see them develop new growth. And it also changes the structure of the plant itself. It's not necessarily going to harm the plant. It's only going to encourage it to push out new growth. The plant is kind of thinking like, hey, you're trying to kill me. I'm going to stop you from doing so by pushing out new growth right behind that.
And how do you know when to cut and when to trim them and where to trim them? Like, which parts of the plant you're supposed to cut?
Well, Madeline, in the Propagation Handbook, my newest book, I say all those things in there. I tell everyone how to do it. But I'll tell you and your listeners now, basically, it's a process, right? But for one, the best time to do it is now. Spring through summer, that's when all plants are actively growing. That's when, if you do take a cutting from a plant, that mother plant, we call it the mother plant that you're taking a cut from, that's mm-hmm. when it's more likely to push out new growth. But when it comes to understanding where to make the cut, that's going to be when you're going to need to have a bit of education and understanding of the type of plant you have. Because you can't just go around and cut any type of plant from any sort of part of the plant that you think will work. You'll have success sometimes just because. And other times it is going to take some real understanding of exactly where to make that cut. So most of us are familiar, let's say, with a pothos. That's a vine-like plant. Many vine-like plants, the thing that makes those the most easiest, I'll say, to propagate is because they have indicators for where to actually make the cut. So on these vine-like plants, most of them have nodes at the end of every single new leaf growth on the vine. And that node mm-hmm. kind of looks like a little bump. It might look like a smaller root, or it could look like an elongated root, which is then called an aerial root. In the wild, when you see these types of vine plants, they use those roots, those aerial roots, to climb trees. Those are the points. If you make a cut below that point and you submerge that node in water or in moist moss, from there, that's where your new growth will develop. But other plants like trees or let's say snake plants, they need to be cut in a different fashion and propagated in a different way to allow root growth. So you just got to know exactly what type of plant you have first so that you can, one, care for it better, but also understand how to propagate it.
What if you have something that's not a vine plant? What if it's a fern? What if it's a ficus? What if it's a cactus?
Oh, I love it. I love all of them. I love ficus. I love ferns, for one, two of the hardest plants to care for. But I will say ficus are tree-like plants, right? So you want to take what is called a tip cut. So instead of looking for a node, you're going to take the cut anywhere on the branch where it is greenish to brownish. The green part of the branch is the newest growth. Once it starts to get brown, that's more mature, and you want to set yourself up for success by basically taking it in between, either in the green part of the branch or in the brownish green part of that branch. And unlike a vine-like plant where you basically are making the cut and knowing that you're submerging that particular node to develop roots from the node, when you take a cut from any sort of tree-like plant, your ficus, your dracaenas, your, let's say, your cactus, right? Like cacti, mm-hmm. you can also take a tip cut from those. You're looking for a spot to make the cut. So because the roots are going to develop from where you make the cut, not from the node of the plant. So when you make the cut, you're going to make a 45 degree angle cut on there so that there's more surface area for roots to develop from where that cut was made. So that's the important thing there. When it comes to ferns, the ferns are either going to be a division and separation type of propagation. You can't really take a cut from any sort of fern and then propagate it. You got to literally go into the root system and separate it there, or you can propagate your ferns by spores. And those spores develop on the bottom sides of most fern leaves. And then basically it's kind of a waiting game, and you got to truly wait. You got to truly make sure your moisture levels are right. You got to make sure your environment's right. And over time you'll develop new ferns from those spores that are on the bottoms of those leaves.
And when you take the plant out and separate it, I'm always afraid I'm going to kill the plant, like kind of ruin its root system by doing
that. For sure. The idea of cutting back a root or stripping a root from another root system can always be stressful. But the thing is, you have to understand that roots grow and grow. And if it's pulled away, most plants will, yes, they will find a way to panic a bit. Then they acclimate to their new surroundings. So don't be discouraged if you do see a little bit of, I would say, the older, more mature growth starting to turn yellow or starting to die back. That's pretty natural, but you can cut away a few roots and still separate it and repot them in different pots.
So that is the divide and conquer method that you would do with a fern. But you also have one more cutting method, and that is the leaf cut method, which is kind of a head scratcher for me. I had no idea you could do this, that you could create a whole new plant from just a leaf.
Yeah, single leaf propagation, whether that's from a begonia, whether that's from a succulent. Many people have succulents. Many people have accidentally propagated a succulent from a single leaf because you know how easy it is to bump a jade, let's say, and a leaf falls off. Maybe it falls directly into the soil of that same pot. And over time, as you're watering and caring for the mother plant there, that leaf will start to push out new growth. So there's many plants. Snake plants can be propagated from a single leaf. Your ZZ plants can be propagated from a single leaf. A peperomia can be propagated from a single leaf. There's plenty of plants that can be propagated in this fashion. It's just, again, knowing the type of plants that can, and then understanding that you're going to have to do a lot more in the process once they do develop roots, and then you transfer them into soil or moss to then care for them, because they're going to be so small that that root system, because it's so small, will require more water than your other plants that have more of established root systems.
Okay. And so with all of these cuttings, what you're doing is you're putting them in water first for the roots to develop.
That's going to be up to you, Madeline. I mean, what is your what is your flavor? You know what I mean? You could go directly into soil. You could put it in sphagnum moss. You could put the cutting in perlite. My favorite, Madeline, is definitely going into water. Now, the reason why I love water propagating is because, for one, I get to see when the root system develops. That to me is the most exciting thing about propagating, is the fact that you get to see the process. And if you propagate in moss or you propagate in soil, you're going to have to water anyway, and you're going to have to be on it. When a cutting is in water, you only have to come back once a week to replenish or refresh that water.
How do you know when they're ready to make the transition into soil?
It's all going to be about length. So if you have any sort of cutting, once the root system grows anywhere between 4 to 6 inches, then it can be transferred into soil. But the thing is, the size of the root system, that root ball, determines the size of the pot you should be placing it in. It's never about the size of the growth of the foliage above the soil. It's all about the size of the root system when it comes to the pot.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Hilton Carter, author of the new book, The Propagation Handbook. And we're talking about how to create cuttings and create new plants from the ones we have. And your book is so beautiful, like your other books, gorgeous photographs. And you can really follow along on how to do this because it's sort of easy to understand the way you've laid it out. So you also talk about the old creating an avocado tree from the pit. I think most of us have tried to do this, is propagate an avocado pit. I have tried and I have failed. What am I doing wrong?
you would have to tell me all the things you did before I can tell you what you did wrong.
I don't know. It just gets kind of dried out and nothing really happens. And then I'm like, why is this thing sitting here? And I put it in the compost and move on.
Oh, the pit itself dries out.
Yeah.
Well, for one, you probably aren't keeping it basically above water just a bit, right?
Does all of it have to be in water, or just half?
No, just like almost half of it, making sure that it stays in that water, making sure that water is staying room temp, not getting too cold because it's near a drafty window. But you're in LA, so it's always perfect, right? It's getting good light. And over time, it should start to crack. But look, everything's not guaranteed when it comes to propagating. And that's why there's many avocado pits for you to try again from, right? I mean, there's many times, like I've said, sometimes it just doesn't take. And I hate when people feel discouraged after they fail once at a propagation, or fail once at just caring for a plant. I hope that at the end of the day, the book sets everyone up for success when it comes to propagating the type of plant they want to propagate. But the real goal, I mean, honestly, at the end of the day for me, is, and you just said this, you've propagated or tried to propagate a pit of an avocado. Most people have tried propagation. I want to give them the handbook, as I say, the overall understanding of how to do it with so many other plants, but hopefully empower them to take a cutting so that they can gift that to someone else, so they can share that passion, that love for plants that they have with someone. I personally know, the power that plants have and how transformative they can be. And it's mainly just the idea of, when you care for something and they provide you something in return. And that's what I get from plants, that love, that zen, that tranquility that they bring me when they're in my home. That gift that I get from plants, that is then given to everyone else. All the other living things that I have around me, I'm able to share that. So I hope that it's not just like, oh, I've propagated before. This should be easy. It should be, oh, I've propagated before, but I haven't propagated that. And I love this plant. The next time I bring that plant in, I'm going to propagate it, take a cutting so that my friend, my mom, my dad, my whomever, my teacher can also have a piece of it so I can share in this joy with those individuals.
Yeah, like a piece of you. So people have a little piece of you in their house too, which is nice.
That would be amazing.
Hilton Carter, his new book is called The Propagation Handbook. He'll be in LA on April 18th for an appearance at the plant store Flora Grub in Venice. Hilton, thank you.
Thank you so much, Madeline. I really appreciate it.
And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back with you again tomorrow.